This is Jennifer Joyner from the Triangle Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from Ghosts from the Coast, a ghostly tour of coastal North Carolina and South Carolina by Nancy Roberts. So sit back and enjoy. Now we're going to double back to Chapter 10. Because last time I had to skip ahead to a shorter chapter, and we had to skip chapter 10. So this is chapter 10, Where Dead Men Walk, Bellamy Mansion, Wilmington, North Carolina. When Dr. John Bellamy locked the front door of his impressive house behind him in 1862, he was uncertain whether he and his wife and 9 children would ever see it again. But there was to be a future for his magnificent house, although not one the owner would like. Dr. Bellamy knew that Fort Fisher, which protected the port city of Wilmington, would inevitably become the prime target of a Union attack. The city was already changing from a sleepy river town to the South's busiest port, its streets and boarding houses overflowing with the rowdy crews of American and British blockade runners. One of the first ships to run the Union blockade was a sidewheeler, the Kate, which brought a large cargo of supplies from Nassau. The city received it with cheers, unaware that death was a passenger on board. Members of the Kate's crew, infected with yellow fever, carried the disease into the city, where it immediately went on a house-to-house rampage. For the people of Wilmington, 1862 was the worst of all years. Each day, wagons clattered along the streets, their drivers collecting the bodies of yellow fever victims for mass burials. As if this were not enough, there was also the threat of a Yankee invasion, a threat that persisted until January 1865, when, as Dr. Bellamy had anticipated, Fort Fisher finally fell, and General Joseph Hawley commandeered the Bellamy Mansion as headquarters for the Union occupation of Wilmington. When the war was over, the Bellamy family returned to Wilmington, and Mrs. Bellamy called upon General Hawley's wife to inquire courteously as to the date they might expect to move back into their home. Mrs. Hawley drew herself up and with great haughtiness declared that she had no intention of moving out. Hearing that the general would not return his house and property, the doctor traveled to Washington and obtained a personal pardon from President Andrew Johnson. The Bellamy family was permitted to move back into the house late in the summer of 1865. Recently, this impressive 22-room mansion was restored and opened to the public. Much of the beautiful original molding, crafted by skilled slave artisans and freedmen under the direction of a young Connecticut draftsman, may still be seen. The Bellamy's prized rosewood William Knabb piano is one of the pieces of the mansion's original furniture on display. Curator Jonathan Nofke looks around him and says thoughtfully, "This is a house of many legends. One story is that if you happen to be here at midnight, you may hear a booted Yankee soldier dash up the front steps." A visitor to the city says, if you are passing by and gaze at the dark shuttered eyes of the white-columned old mansion, it doesn't take a sixth sense to know that something is really here. This house has a long and well-deserved reputation for being haunted, Curator Nofke says. There is no single apparition in a particular place. Here it is in different places. It seems to move around. He compares the ambiance of the Bellamy Mansion to that of the grand houses of William Faulkner's stories. "But of course you want to know what ghosts are here," says Nofke. "I have had no personal experience with any, but when they were filming a movie here, prior to the 1993 and 1994 restoration, quite a startling story was told me by the location scout. He and the director were in the library looking through some old papers that were blackened by a fire which occurred here in 1972, and this is what he said. We had locked the door behind us and were completely alone in the house when suddenly we heard the heavy front door open and slam shut with a loud bang. A cold blast of air rushed through the closed door up the stairs and into the library where we were working. Our papers sailed through the air in every direction. Within seconds, we were out of there and racing down the steps when we heard the library door slam shut over our heads. That was followed by an angry pounding on it as if someone had been ejected and was furiously attempting to get back in. We ran down another flight of stairs to the ground floor beneath the house. I gathered they were very frightened, smiled the curator. But let me mention the third floor of the mansion. It is not only physically very different from the rest of the house, but so is its atmosphere. People walking up from the second to the third floor often mention being uncomfortable on the stairs and feeling ill at ease upstairs. Visitors who claim psychic sensibilities are plainly eager to leave that floor. The third floor contains the bedrooms that once belonged to the 9 Bellamy children. As for people seeing things, says the curator, it does not happen up there. The second floor is where it happens. Volunteers report that when they are locking up, they glimpse the bottom of a trouser leg or the flutter of a long skirt moving out of the room just ahead of them. It is as if someone was just leaving. I've never had any of these experiences myself, but I serve as a clearinghouse for them. Whatever ghosts are reported to inhabit the mansion seem to be non-threatening, reticent presences. A strange incident occurred some years back, the curator continued. A film crew was driving by, and they reported seeing an elderly couple staring out a window on the third floor. Others have also seen them. The pair stand in the double window behind the balcony and gaze out over Market Street. Hostesses here have had their own experiences, such as being in a room and feeling that they were not alone. On one occasion, I was talking to a group of volunteers, giving them pointers, when one of the volunteers named Kim suddenly cried out. I looked at her, startled. "Pardon me, sir," she said, "but I just saw a figure standing behind you, looking over your shoulder." The house and the history-making events that have taken place here provide a popular background for Civil War reenactments and, more than once, an encounter with something more. Jim Morgan, a Wilmington reenactor, and a group of other men playing the part of Union soldiers were to spend the night in the Bellamy Mansion, where Union soldiers lived and slept during the war. Morgan's son Robert persuaded his father to let him go along. "I've heard stories that things happen in that house, Dad, and I would like to spend the night there," said the youth. The fact that his son was eager to experience something supernatural irritated his father, who was a thoroughgoing skeptic. But he consented, believing that Robert would at least absorb some Wilmington Civil War history. During the night, Mr. Morgan was awakened by peals of laughter and sounds suspiciously like pillow fighting from the third floor. He immediately thought Robert might be involved, so he rose from his pallet on the parlor floor, where the reenactors lay sleeping, and hurried up the stairs. Sweeping the beam of his flashlight through the rooms, he discovered that they were empty. No one was sleeping on the third floor. Continuing his search, he finally found his son with some friends, all lying peacefully asleep on the second floor. Returning to the parlor, Morgan lay back down, still wondering about the laughter he had heard. Then, tired from the day's activities, he dropped off to sleep. But during the early morning hours, his rest was broken once more. He waked to feel the pressure of heavy boots striding roughly across his body. Outraged, Morgan was convinced that some of his reenactor buddies were playing a dumb joke on the rest of them. The sleepy, angry shouts of his comrades and their imprecations began to fill the air. To his astonishment, Morgan saw the shadowy figures of Union soldiers walking over the sleeping bodies of the reenactors. He and his comrades, now thoroughly awake, began to strike out at them. Two of the reenactors turned on flashlights, determined to see who the practical jokers were and teach them a good lesson. When someone hit the parlor light switch, which illuminated the entire room, and found it empty, the reenactors fell silent. With awestruck faces, they looked around them. The dark figures had vanished. Men, with hands raised to strike, found themselves facing only each other, and sheepishly they lowered their fists. Everyone lay down again, but there was little sleep to be had that night for Morgan. The listening to men turn restlessly from one side to the other, he couldn't go back to sleep, and as he thought about what had happened, he had a queasy feeling. Would they return? The thought of those tall, shadowy figures made his flesh creep. Finally, he dozed off, and the next thing he knew, it was light. His son was leaning over him, a hand on his shoulder. "Hey, Dad, wake up," Robert said. "Wow, what a wasted night. This house doesn't have any ghosts." Robert was ready to go home. The reenactment went on until the following afternoon, and no one mentioned the events of the night before. But later they began to discuss plans for another reenactment, and invariably someone would comment upon how hard it was to sleep in old houses. They questioned each other cautiously, not wanting to risk ridicule. Several finally admitted that the place gave them nightmares and mentioned soldiers walking over them while they slept. Many longtime residents of Wilmington, and some of the staff who work at the Bellamy Mansion, believe it to be the most haunted house in the city. The Bellamy Mansion Museum is open year-round for touring. It is located at 503 Market Street. For information, phone 910-251-3700. Chapter 11. The Haunted Wilmington Library, New Hanover County Public Library, Wilmington, North Carolina. The new library in Gainesville, Georgia, has a ghost, and when I wrote about it for my book, Georgia Ghosts, it never occurred to me that I would soon discover a second haunted library. Beverly Tedderton, of the North Carolina Room, tells of more than one ghost said to haunt the New Hanover County Public Library. Spectral visitors have been reported at two locations of the library. The Old Armory, first in use as the library during the Civil War, and the building where the library is currently located. The library's present location was formerly the site of a wealthy family's private home. Books donated to the library by the family are now housed in the North Carolina Historical Collection. Here is where much, but not all, of the ghostly activity takes place. Could a ghost have arrived along with the old books? Mrs. Tedderton, a former employee at Colonial Williamsburg, has transferred her enthusiasm for history to Wilmington. Her interest in pirates, secret tunnels to the river from some of the historic houses, and the network of storm sewage tunnels, some high enough for a man to stand up in, beneath the old city, hint of years of high adventure. But back to the supernatural. Mrs. Tedderton has had a number of experiences herself. "Some of them are just sounds, sounds that only a librarian might be familiar with," she says, "like a patron shelving a book, pages being leafed back and forth as people do when they search through an index, file drawers being opened and closed. Some nights I've sat for hours at my desk, and all the time I could hear so much activity back there in the stacks. The sounds would begin as if someone were putting their elbows on a metal shelf to read, or books were being placed with a thump on a shelf. Yet I would know that the last person had left the library because I had just said goodnight to them. We have locked up at night and returned the next morning to find every drawer in the pamphlet file case unlocked and one or more left partially open. When we worked at the old library, the one that had the tall bushes around it and did not close until 8 o'clock, we had a strict closing procedure. I would walk through the stacks with a co-worker and all over the building just to be sure no one was locked in accidentally. I walked the building myself, and so in my own mind I felt sure no one was there but the two of us. One night, shortly after I began working there, we had been through the stacks and we were walking near the circulation desk, which was on our left. Back down the hall were the stacks. We both saw a shadow move, and I said, 'Oh, there's someone still left in the building.' 'We need to get out of here now,' my co-worker replied. 'Get your hat and pocketbook, then let's go outside.' We were standing in front of the building, breathless, when I asked her, 'What was that all about?' And she answered, 'Didn't you know this building is haunted?' That was my introduction to the ghosts of the soldiers of the past, the Wilmington Light Infantry. The Wilmington Light Infantry were in that building during the time it was an armory. Mrs. Tedderton thought she had left incidents of that sort behind her when they moved to the new library, but it seems they were here, too. One day a patron came out of the stacks and up to me to report seeing a woman going around the corner of an aisle of shelves. She tried to catch up to tell her the library was closing when she faded and disappeared. Other sightings have been reported to her by library patrons, but Mrs. Tedderton prefers not to identify them. Sometimes that embarrasses people. On separate occasions, the apparition of a woman researcher was seen by two male patrons, says Mrs. Tedderton. The woman they described was very similar in appearance to a local historian we all knew and respected who died several years ago. One thing I love about being a librarian is assisting people with historical research. The problems they bring to me are never the same. The story I'm going to tell you illustrates that and is one of the most interesting experiences I've had since working in the library. I was sitting here at my desk one afternoon when a woman came in who was not a patron I knew. The first thing she said was, "I'm so upset, you must help me. I want to see all your ghost story files." When I began, I had no idea I was going to be drawn into the midst of a contemporary ghost story. She told me that the night before she had been waked up in the early morning hours by a ruckus out in the hall and had heard something very frightening. She stays in a lodging house in the middle of the historic district, an interesting old white house, one of the few with a second floor balcony. She went on to describe her experience, saying, "I was sound asleep when I was awakened by noises and the sound of scuffling right outside my door. This was followed by a woman's imploring voice crying out, 'Major Clark, don't do it. Please don't do that. Please, Major Clark.' There was the crack of a shot and a scream. I heard the sound of something heavy being pulled to the top of the stairs, and as it was dragged down, it went bump, bump, bump with a dull thud as it hit each stair. I knew it had to be a body, and I lay in bed petrified. I could hear it slide heavily across the floor toward the door of the downstairs hall. Then I heard the creak of the front door opening, and the dragging noise resumed, as if a weight was being pulled over the threshold and out onto the porch. Finally, the door closed, and to my relief, I could hear no more. The next morning, when I awakened, all was silent in the house, and immediately I went out my door to look in the hall. There was no reason to think anything unusual had happened, nor were there signs of any disturbance. Somehow I became increasingly sure that this was not something that happened last night, but that it was an actual event that had happened in that house years ago. Someone must have heard all this before, and I'm wondering if it is in your file of ghost story clippings." I was not familiar with it, but I gave her the file, and she searched. There was nothing there. And we had exhausted every possible source I knew of for her to check. The hour is drawing towards 5 o'clock, and I had a report to complete, so I tried a last resort to satisfy her that nothing had occurred. That is what I really believed. I suggested that she try the microfilm and look up the Wilmington newspaper for 100 years ago yesterday. With this to keep her occupied, I went back to my desk and my work. I was surprised to see her return before long, her face pink with excitement. "Mrs. Tedderton, this is it. The next day, 100 years after last night's date. Read this." While I stood searching the microfilm, she pointed to a few lines at the very bottom of the page. There in the Wilmington paper was a 3-line notice, and I read these words: "Major Clark was found lying dead this morning at the foot of Orange Street." Just that, and no details as to how he met his death. "And where's the house you live in?" I inquired. "Orange Street," she replied. "I live at 413 Orange Street." And now her face had turned chalk white. "I know what happened in that house, for I heard it take place. Major Clark tried to kill someone, and instead they killed him." "I wish I could help you," I said to her. This event was before the filing of death certificates in Wilmington, so there was no way to look up Major Clark and the cause of death. "It could be in either a Union or Confederate officer. Both were here during the Civil War." "If anything else happens in the house, may I come back?" "Of course, if you think there might be something in our files." She turned. "Mrs. Tedderton, you've been so helpful and seem to know so much about ghosts. You do, don't you? I started to say no, and then thought of all the tales told to me by my Scandinavian grandmother, not to mention experiences working in haunted libraries. Well, perhaps you are right, I admitted. If you do discover any more information about the Major, do let me know. The New Hanover County Public Library is located at 201 Chestnut Street. And now we're back in the correct order. We're at Chapter 13, which is back in South Carolina. Someone watching over me. Oliver's Lodge, Merle's Inlet, South Carolina. This story began in South Carolina back in the 1940s, the back of the bus days when everyone took segregation for granted, and restrooms had colored painted on one door and white on the other. Those who know South Carolina well say it is a state of contradictions, where emotions between races run high about a Confederate battle flag, yet astonishing acts of kindness also occur. The setting is Oliver's Lodge at Merle's Inlet. Diners sit gazing out the windows at colors like those of a melting Van Gogh painting. The late afternoon sun transforms the marsh grass into a sea of molten gold, then a glowing bluff. As darkness sets in, the jet-black crescent of Garden City across the water is strewn with lights. Oliver's Lodge is a rustic, weathered place started nearly a century ago by a steamboat captain on the Waccamaw River. Leaving the river for good, Captain Bill Oliver and his wife Emma opened a fishing and hunting lodge at Merle's Inlet during the early 1900s. Then came their retirement, and Captain Bill's son Matt continued the business, but as a restaurant. Oliver's Lodge became one of the first coastal restaurants to serve local seafood, instead of the traditional southern fare of fried chicken and country ham. It was famous for its roast oysters, fresh fish of all kinds, soft-shell crabs, and delectable patties made from the carefully picked meat of the local hard-shell crabs. Tourists heard of it, and for them, as well as the natives, dining here became a tradition. It was not uncommon to see out-of-state couples returning on the same date each year. The restaurant seems to draw people back. During the 1940s, when Mac Oliver ran it, he would rise about 6 o'clock for breakfast, and a short while later, hear the padding of bare feet on the back porch. When he opened the kitchen door, he would find several black boys holding buckets filled with live blue crabs, their claws waving desperately in the air. The boys had caught them at daybreak and were bringing them to the lodge to sell. The youngest of the group was an engaging 7-year-old, whose given name was Roosevelt, but the others called him Rooster. Rooster would rise at dawn at his house in a community called Waccamaw Plantation, where he lived with 11 brothers and sisters. Then he would head off to meet his friends and catch crabs. In the first light, the boys skittered here and there on the tidelands, chasing the elusive creatures. With the swift stab of a forked stick, they would pin the crab's claws down, scoop it up, and plop it into their bucket. But one morning, Rooster didn't join the other boys. The reason was his daddy, a daddy who was the cause of most of the trouble in Rooster's world. His father usually began drinking in the evening, and by dawn he was lying on a sofa passed out. When he woke up, Rooster didn't want to be there. That was the way it was that morning, so Rooster tried to dress very quietly and slip out of the house without being heard. But suddenly the snores on the sofa ceased, and his father opened his bloodshot eyes. His gaze fell upon the boy. Rooster tells the story of what happened, even to the words, although it was long ago. My father started by asking, "Where's that kindling wood you supposed to fetch, Rooster? I don't see it. That means you ain't brought it in, you sorry little rascal. I'll learn you." On unsteady legs, he rose from the sofa and stood in front of me. I tried to dodge past him, but he filled my path. His big hands grabbed me. Daddy slung me around, and taking both my wrists, he secured them with his belt, then looped it over the wooden bar that held the door closed. Walking over to the wall, where a pile of switches lay over two wooden pegs, he was very deliberately picking out a limber one, and brought the switch down across my back, then my legs. I felt it burning like a stingray out in the surf. As it wound around and around me, and I shouted, "Daddy, stop! Stop!" My mama stood there crying and begging, "Stop! Please stop! Oh, please!" over and over, but he never seemed to pay her any attention, no matter how much she begged him. Finally, Daddy decided he wanted some backer out of his jacket on the back porch. He went after it, hollering back, "Don't you be going nowhere, young'un. I ain't through with you yet." But I got that strap off my wrist and was out of the door. When my feet hit the ground, they were flying. "All I had on was my undershirt, no pants," he recalls. I ran past a white man I knew, and he called to me, "Rooster, where's your pants, boy?" "I got shorts on, sir," I called back and keep running. I ran 2 miles until I had no breath left when I reached Oliver's lodge. All I could do was crawl into the cool darkness under the porch, my body and neck on fire from the pain of the switch. Maxine, Mr. Oliver's daughter, says that later that morning, when her father went down the steps, he heard a sound coming from somewhere nearby, a sound like a whimpering puppy. Getting down on his knees, his eyes probed the darkness beneath the porch until they rested on something white, Rooster's undershirt. The boy's face was turned toward him, and when he saw him, he called in a weak voice, "Mr. Mac, oh, Mr. Mac," and he crawled painfully out into the sunlight. "Rooster, who did this to you?" asked Mac Oliver, his blue eyes dark with rage. "Tell me." "My daddy." Mac Oliver took him into the house, where his wife, Teenie, lifted the undershirt. Long red stripes curled savagely around the small body from his legs up to his neck. Teenie Oliver bathed the raw welts raised by the limber switch and spread salve on them. Then, after they fed him, Mac Oliver told Rooster to get into the car. At first, Rooster hesitated, afraid he was being taken home. "Don't worry, we're not going to your daddy's house," said Mr. Oliver quietly. "Just get in." They drove to Polly's Island, where Mac Oliver knocked on the door of the magistrate's office. "This is Roosevelt Pickett," he said to the magistrate. The name Pickett had come down from plantation days when slaves received the surname of their owners. Gently peeling back Rooster's shirt to expose the bloody stripes for the magistrate to see, Oliver said, "His father beat the pure tar out of him, and I'm not letting this child go home." "What are you going to do with the boy, Mac?" asked the magistrate. "Take care of him, that's what," came the reply. The magistrate looked surprised, then shrugged. "Well, I'll try to help you all I can," he said, "but first I'm going to have to go over and talk with his father." Mr. Oliver and Rooster drove back to Merle's Inlet. Late that afternoon, the magistrate's dusty, dark blue Plymouth sedan turned off Highway 17 into the narrow road to the lodge, and parked near the giant live oak between the lodge and the marshlands. "Mac, I went over there and told Roosevelt's father he hadn't ought to whip any kid the way he did Rooster, and I'd send him to jail if he did it again. I think I scared him up pretty good. Of course, he wants Rooster back, but says he's willing to let him stay at your place till he wants to come home." Rooster never went home, nor did he ever speak to his father again. The Oliver's daughter, Maxine, was 11 then, and she and the little boy soon became fast friends. "I didn't think anything about Mom and Dad taking him in," Maxine says now with a shrug. "They just told me he needed help. Mother bought his clothes, and on Christmas morning he had presents, just like the rest of us." From the day Mac Oliver found Roosevelt curled up under the front porch, the Oliver family took care of him. They fed and clothed him, took him to the doctor when he needed to go, and saw that he attended school. Mac Oliver taught him how to cook, clean, and make house repairs. In his teens, when Rooster developed a rare eye disease, the Olivers took him to a specialist at the College of Charleston, then Duke, and finally Emory. But the top medical schools had no cure. The doctors were unable to save his left eye. That never stopped Rooster from doing his job at the lodge. "If hands and feet are needed to do it, I can get it done," he says today. He also kept his connection with his mother, taking part of his paycheck to her every week as long as she lived. "Mr. Oliver would get me up every morning about 6 o'clock, saying, 'Roosevelt, hit the deck.' I'd help him fix breakfast earlier on Sunday because of church, but if it was a weekday, we'd eat together, and then he would start me to cleaning or show me how to do some repair around the lodge. About 7:30, Mr. Hawkins, Maxine's husband, would come over. He would take about 50 or 60 pounds of food, say, from the restaurant the night before, and sometimes we'd pick up more from the Animal Right to Life organization, which he had founded. Then we would head out on our route. Each morning there must have been 100 cats sitting beside Turntable Road waiting. There were also mother dogs with puppies. Sometimes we could get the animals adopted. Once I saw something move in a dumpster, and when I reached down and uncovered it, it was a tiny kitten. Jane and Mickey Spillane adopted that one. It never seems to have occurred to Rooster that one day Mac Oliver, and even their daughter Maxine, would not be able to run Oliver's Lodge any longer. That was unthinkable. They were his people, along with his own mother, whom he depended upon and who meant everything to him. But the time came when they put the lodge up for sale. Rooster, a tall, calm man, whose present-day beard lends dignity to his expression, was unperturbed. While they waited for a buyer, he continued to catch crabs for the table, repair the pier and house, and stand in the dining room, looking out through the windows at the fall hurricanes. One morning the Olivers called him into the kitchen, where they had all worked together for many years, and with deep sadness broke the news that the restaurant had been sold. "I thought that was the end for me at Oliver's Lodge," said Rooster. But that would have been out of character for Mac Oliver. He made the sale contingent on Rooster's being given a free room in the lodge for life. Rooster began to perform similar duties for the new owners. He liked to watch the storms. During the third week of September in 1989, he heard that a worse storm than usual was on the way. Everyone was calling it Hugo. Rooster knew that all the tourists and most of the natives were evacuating. Maxine asked him to stay at her house with them, but he didn't think it was necessary. He never had left the lodge for a storm. That night he was awakened by the rain beating wildly on the windows. He sat on the edge of his bed looking out, lit a cigarette, and forgot to smoke when something hurled past his window. Going downstairs, he went over to the windows across the front of the lodge dining room to get a better view. He watched the wind tear the lodge pier off its pilings. He had fished there often. Still, he wasn't afraid. The next morning, he saw the ground covered with debris in every direction. Large boats had been plucked out of the water by the wind and hurled 200 yards or more across Highway 17. The entire second-floor dining room of a well-known seafood restaurant nearby had been blown away, and he was shaken. For the first time, Roosevelt realized how easily that gust of tornado-like wind could have struck just a mile south and sliced off part of Oliver's Lodge. He heard the weather report on the radio calling Hugo the worst storm in 50 years. The old lodge had weathered it and sheltered him once more. The soft-spoken black man sums it up. "I guess it takes seeing something like Hurricane Hugo to start you thinking. I wouldn't have believed it, that I would ever get away from Daddy. Then to be taken in by the Olivers and have them treat me like family. I think someone has to be looking after me who really cares about my life. And maybe Mr. Oliver puts in a good word for me up there now and then." Oliver's Lodge is on the water and cannot be seen from the road. The sign for it is beside the road at 4204 Business Highway 17, Murrells Inlet. Chapter 14. Does the Gray Man Still Walk? Polly's Island, South Carolina. Captain Nance's restaurant at Murrells Inlet is one of my favorite seafood places, and when oysters are in season, I am irresistibly drawn there. One night in March of 1998, my husband and I had arrived later than usual, and although we were sitting at one of the coveted tables overlooking the water, the beautiful view had been lost in the gathering darkness. It was almost 8 o'clock now, and lights across the water traced the curved arc of the land that is Garden City. After our wait person took our order, my husband asked her, "Do you happen to know any ghost stories in this area?" "I know about something that happened to me," she replied. She was gray-haired, grandmotherly-looking, in her early 60s. "Tell us about it," I said with interest. One morning I was driving back to Polly's from my job at the paper mill in Georgetown. I knew I was driving too fast. When you've worked all night, you're tired. So tired, you get careless. We saw her customers at a nearby table signal her. She nodded to let them know she would be there, then glanced down at her Timex watch. "I'm sorry," she said. You see how busy we are right now. But if you will wait until, say, about 8:30, I'll be glad to tell you how it happened." There was a flash of something akin to fear in her blue eyes as she recalled it. "Wait? For what promised to be a good story? Of course we could. This is an area that is rich in ghost lore." We began to speculate about what our wait person would tell us. Every time I came to the South Carolina coast thinking I knew all of its secrets, I would hear something astounding. The low country stories seemed inexhaustible, and I constantly hear new ones. Not stories from 100 years ago, but supernatural occurrences that are going on right now. "Do you really believe that some man dressed in gray warns people on Polly's Island before hurricanes?" my husband asked as we waited. When I first started writing, I found the story of the gray man the most difficult to believe. The tragedy that is said to be the origin of the story occurred about 200 years ago. Some believe that the gray man is Percival Polly, who founded Polly's Island. But I think yet another tale is more apt to be the true basis. Older residents of the island have said that the gray man is the ghost of a young man from a prominent family who died out on Polly's in 1800. Returning from a long sea voyage, he was in high spirits. His wedding was to take place soon, and along with a family servant, he was on his way, for the first time since his return, to visit his fiancée. He was so eager to see the girl that he rode at a reckless pace, not heeding the warnings of his servant. His horse stumbled and threw him into a pocket of quicksand. There, despite his struggles, he was rapidly drawn beneath the surface of the wet sand. The spirit of the young lover who died such a horrible death is said to stay on to warn and protect others from disaster. Over the years, many claim to have seen his ghost striding along the beach or in the vicinity of Polly's. Descriptions never match. Some say he is a faceless apparition. In one of my books, The Ghost of the Gray Man warned a family from Georgetown to leave the island. That was just 2 hours before Hurricane Hazel struck with no warning. In another story, a young woman from Charleston was told to leave the island late at night while she was in the family beach house all alone. When the gray man visits a family before an approaching hurricane, he directs them to leave the island immediately. Oddly enough, when they return to their house, they are surprised to find nothing has been damaged. No sand has been deposited on the ground floor by receding water. No towels blown off the line where they had been carefully hung. No toys washed off the porch and left strewn about the beach. My husband and I discussed what families have said after 3 different storms. All they can report is, "We were warned to leave immediately." We don't know who the man could have been, only that he visited no other family on the island. They have never seen him before in their lives. "Has TV ever done anything on it?" asked my husband. "As it happens, I was one of the advisors for a TV episode produced by Unsolved Mysteries about the phenomenon. When it was filmed, 3 couples met in Georgetown to describe their encounters with the gray man. Most of the customers were gone now, and as the last tables were being cleared, our wait person, Joyce, joined us for coffee and began the story she had promised us. It was one morning when I was leaving work at Georgetown to come home to Polly's. It was late September, and I will never forget what a scare it gave me. When I walked out of the paper mill after work that morning, I remember thinking how tired I was and that I didn't feel like making the drive back home to the island. It wasn't even 8 o'clock in the morning, and I already knew it would be a sweltering day. I could hardly wait to take a shower and go to sleep in my air-conditioned bedroom. I walked over to my dark blue Chrysler. You remember all that chrome they used to have. That's what it looked like. Sliding behind the wheel, I headed north in the direction of Polly's Island. Up ahead, the sky was full of dark, chunky clouds like a bad storm was coming. I looked at my gas gauge. I could probably make it, and I wanted to get home and to bed. Then I recall seeing a convenience store and thinking to myself, I really should go ahead and fill up the tank. It delayed me a little, but I comforted myself with a honey bun for the road and drove on. When I was almost to Polly's, the clouds had grown more ominous and a fine rain began to fall. I was sleepy, and I noticed myself repeatedly drifting over the line in the middle of the road. Then I turned the wheel back too quickly to straighten the car, and it skidded. Without my realizing it, my Reebok was pressing down harder on the accelerator than I thought. I tried to be more alert and drove on 3 or 4 miles. Then it happened again, and that really woke me up. But by now, I was almost at the island. It's crazy to drive when you are this tired, I thought, and began thinking for the umpteenth time about getting a job near Polly's Island that would pay as well as the one I had in Georgetown. Darn, I was winging it down the road again. Clouds of mist went flying past my side windows, and suddenly, for a terrifying moment, the road ahead was completely blotted out. Then there was an instant of heartfelt relief when it cleared, but as I zoomed around a curve at about 70 miles an hour, I saw a man standing squarely in my path. There was no time to think, only to furiously pump the brakes, and I did. Surely the crazy fellow would move, but he didn't. He just stood there in the morning mist, wearing some sort of old-timey clothes with his arms spread out like a cornfield scarecrow. I was almost upon him. I stomped down so hard on that brake pedal, I thought my foot would go clean through the floor. I knew that would throw the Chrysler into a nasty skid, and it did. My tires screeched like banshees, and I began sliding all over the wet asphalt. How I straightened the car out and stopped, I will never know. When I peered through the windshield, there he was, still standing right in front of me. But as I sat gaping at him, he suddenly disappeared. Edging the car forward a foot or two, I started searching the shoulder on both sides of the road for a figure. Not a soul could be seen. As the sun burned through the mist ahead, I remember groaning weakly, "Oh," and then breaking out into a cold perspiration. I felt faint, for I had narrowly escaped my worst nightmare. In the middle of my lane, just a few feet ahead of me, was a flatbed truck that had dropped a load of pine trees, the biggest trees I had ever seen. They had broken loose from the chains holding them on the truck and rested on the asphalt right in my path. Fixed to the end of that last log, someone had tied a red bandana. I got out of my car and walked toward the cab of the truck to speak to the driver. It was empty. Nor was anyone to be seen along the shoulders. I have always had a horror of being behind one of these flatbeds and having its load slip the chains. I could visualize the giant-sized burden falling either in front of me or off on the side of the truck on top of me as I passed. Barreling along at the speed I was going, if I had not seen the man standing there and managed to stop, I would have collided with the logs piled up like jackstraws and been killed. And then I thought, if I hadn't taken those few more minutes to stop and fill up gas before I left Georgetown for Polly's, I might have been traveling right behind it when those logs dropped. My husband looked at her with awe. "Joyce, was that the famous gray man warning you?" "All I know is I saw that man standing right in the middle of the lane in front of me," she replied. "And whoever he was God's doing." In my years of writing, I've heard many variants of this well-known South Carolina story. Accounts of the Gray Man, as seen by different people, may be found in two of my other books, Ghosts of the Carolinas and South Carolina Ghosts, From the Coast to the Mountains. Chapter 15, The Legendary Hugo, McClellansville, South Carolina. George Matt's desk calendar read Thursday, September 21st, 1989. He had known for several days that Hurricane Hugo would probably strike the South Carolina coast that night. Metz was an experienced paramedic who had been on duty through many a hurricane, but he knew that this time, with all the storm warnings, most homeowners had left the area to go inland. Of course, there would always be a few diehards who would stay, he thought. They would be inside their waterfront houses now, waiting out the storm. He visualized them laughing and joking as people did at hurricane parties, watching TV reports, rising from their game of Penny Ante poker to pour themselves another drink, or frowning with concentration over how to bid their bridge hand. Later, some of the guests would fall asleep on the sofa or guest room bed while others took their place in the game. The roar of the wind and rat-tat-tat of the rain pelting the house gave these events just the right taste of danger, making an exciting backdrop for the sociability within. He remembered the young couple in the jeep riding along the beach that afternoon, probably loving the excitement of it, heads turned seaward to feel the spray in their face from the charging breakers. Warnings that this storm could be dangerous had come well in advance, and more people than usual had headed inland, some to Columbia, and even a few to Charlotte. In some ways, Metz was probably much like other men. He was married, loved his wife and three children, a girl and two boys, and sometimes worked long hours. But it was his job that was different. You could never predict when something was going to happen, and from the moment a call came in to Medic 6 Station, he was under intense pressure. He might be speeding to the scene to help an accident or crime victim, transporting someone to the hospital, or giving assistance at any type of disaster. Paramedics can be compared to the life-saving crews of the Carolina coast before the present-day Coast Guard stations were built. Courage, a willingness to face personal danger, and swift judgment are necessary qualities. Like the early lifesavers who went out time after time into a boiling surf, Metz was a born rescuer. His assignment came Thursday evening, to go to the shelter at Lincoln High School in McClellansville, and he was confident that he could meet any challenges that lay ahead. Expecting long hours of grueling work and bone weariness later, he had no premonition of a greater personal danger than usual. It was fortunate that he was a man who dealt calmly with whatever happened. Metz and a good friend of his, fellow medic Tim Lockridge, drenched by gusts of wind and squalls of rain, carried their equipment and supplies into the arts and crafts room. They arranged their boxes of medical supplies brought from the station, and since there was nothing else to do, they hung up their wet clothes to dry and used the craft tables as makeshift bunks. They talked now and then, but mostly attended to the job at hand. Metz and Tim could anticipate what was needed, and they made a good team. An hour later, a man stuck his head in the door and asked, "Can you bring an invalid over here from my house?" He led them there in the blackest night imaginable, no street lights or house lights. They found the invalid and his frightened wife, waiting in the house. By flashlight, Metz and Tim brought the man out on a stretcher, packed his wheelchair into their unit, and rushed the man and his wife to the school. The rain was now so hard it stung their cheeks. Minutes later, someone else ducked his head in the door. "Can you go and pick up my Uncle Joe?" he asked. Metz had already gone by Joe's late that afternoon, and the man had refused to come to the shelter. He shook his head and said, "Sorry, the winds are too high now. He will probably be okay." Now the storm was at its peak, and in the cafeteria not far from them, the lights had gone out. Tim was attempting to read, and Metz lay on the table, unable to sleep. The lights in their room went out, and except for the hall and emergency lights, the entire school was plunged into darkness. Then the hall lights were gone, too. There was nothing to do now until the storm was over, so they both tried to rest and succeeded in dozing off to sleep. "Then, I don't know how it happened," says Metz, "but somehow, in my sleep, I heard a voice say, 'Get up!' Startled wide awake in seconds, I was struck by a silence so total it was eerie. I sensed, rather than knew, that something was terribly wrong. Then I heard it. It was the swooshing sound of rushing water very near us. I waked Tim, and as I hurriedly shoved my feet into my shoes to go and find the source, I glanced over at the baseboard air conditioners. They were swelling in toward us, and water surged and gurgled between the vents. We ran back and forth, piling valuable equipment on the table as the water rose around our feet. It was soon ankle-deep, and I abandoned any attempt to place personal gear where it would stay dry. Together, Tim and I managed to wrench open the door into the hall so that we could get out. I felt the water rising higher around my legs. As we reached the cafeteria, the door unexpectedly came open in my hand and pulled me through it in seconds. But the rapidly rising water inside slammed the door shut behind me. I tried to pull it open, staring helplessly at Tim's horrified face pressed against the glass of the door. He pushed back, but to no avail. He was trapped, and with a sick feeling I knew it. I was on one side with the parents and children we were to help, and my partner was shut out in the hall, the door held closed by the water within the cafeteria. Tim and I were now out of contact with each other. Our dispatcher and our walkie-talkies were out of commission. There was nothing I could do for him. On my side of the door, the cafeteria was full of people, and everyone was rushing toward the stage. If the people in that room were to survive, it was my duty to help them. I waded over to the wall and began to lift women and children up on a table. Everyone looked frightened, but they were still keeping very quiet. Of course, there was always the danger that panic would spread through the crowd. Children were already crying, and a few women on the stage were hysterical. But fortunately, their hysteria had not yet spread. The people near them took control, calming them. Out in the hall, Jennings Austin, the principal of Lincoln High, dashed past the glass doors of the cafeteria, a screaming crowd following behind him as he sought some exit, any exit from the building. A few minutes later, he passed, going in the opposite direction, his frantic entourage following close behind him. Regardless of what exit the principal tried, the doors were all held closed by the force of the water coming in from the ocean. I looked through the glass door at them, my eyes searching the crowd. Where was Tim? I could see out through the tall plexiglass windows, and the water out there was higher than the water on our side of the glass, which was up to my waist. Someone took a fire extinguisher and began banging it against the windows, but stopped when people began shouting, "No, no!" They realized that if the water from outside came in, it would raise the level in the room and we would all drown. "Our Father who art in heaven," desperately I began to pray the Lord's Prayer, "hallowed be thy name." And then my mind went blank. As many times as I have said it, I couldn't remember the rest. A black lady stood near me with two small children, and I said, "May I hold the young one there for you?" In minutes, the water had risen to my chest. She handed me the 3-year-old, whose name was Sara. I tried to comfort the little girl by talking and singing. Then I attempted to quiet a hysterical woman, who, afraid that she would fall beneath the water, began to hyperventilate. The water was growing deeper by the second, and I knew that if she fell, she would take others down with her. Several people appeared agitated already by her calls for help. Somehow I had to calm her down, so I spoke as quietly as I could to her, so others would stay cool. I was every bit as frightened as everyone else, but I knew I had to hang on to myself. In the midst of these thoughts, I thought of Tim and hoped he had found a table or something high to stand on. Now the water was up over my chest, and I could smell cooking grease and gasoline fumes from cars. That meant that the water must be deep enough for stoves and cars to be floating around outside the school. I kept saying, "Please, Lord, don't let me drop this kid," and at the same time praying for my own little girl and family. Were they in a safe place? I talked to the child, continuing to hold her above water level. On the other side of the room, someone had gotten up on the roof and broken a top window pane. A few had climbed to safety, but I knew the woman couldn't swim across the cafeteria, nor could I, not holding a 3-year-old. I watched the clock on the wall. What accurate time it kept, but the hands seemed to move so slowly. What was I doing to help anybody? My job is to be a paramedic, I thought. Am I letting people down? Then I realized that I was just as helpless as anyone else. All of us could drown right here in one mass grave. When we realized the water had finally stopped rising, there was a great sense of relief. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning that I gave the child back to her mother and watched them walk out with everyone else. The life-threatening experience had only lasted about 2 or 3 hours. But if the water had stayed that high much longer, some would have drowned, and others would have suffered hypothermia. The first person I saw outside was Tim, and we stopped to give each other a bear hug. He had been up on the roof, hanging on for dear life in that wind. An off-duty constable and I searched the school for bodies in the knee-high water. I remember being thankful that we didn't find any. Outside, houses had been swept off their foundations and out into the middle of the road. Water was bubbling up here and there like a witch's brew. I knew it might be coming from gas mains, and that's scary. Parts of Business Highway 17 were completely washed away. Everywhere there was this unnatural quiet. No people, no traffic, not even any chirping of birds. Nor did the birds begin to sing again until mid-morning. I didn't realize until later that a 17-foot wall of water called a storm surge had struck the school. Lincoln High, designated as a shelter, was about 10 feet above sea level, not the 20 feet the hurricane evacuation study had estimated. I think that with more than 1,100 people trapped in that school, it was the protecting hand of God that none of us died, says the medic wonderingly. For George Metz, these recollections will always be just beneath the surface of his mind. I do what I have to do when storms come, but even now, if the wind begins blowing really hard, memories of Hugo come flooding back. Then I feel the hairs on the back of my neck rise. Hurricane Hugo hit the Carolinas more than a decade ago. It is said to have been the worst storm in 50 years. Soon afterward, people wore shirts boasting, "I survived Hugo," to show that even after the unthinkable had happened, they were still here. In the hardest areas hit, it is still the storm against which all other storms are measured. We've run out of time for today's chapter of Ghosts from the Coast. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Joyner, reading for the Triangle Reading Service. So long, until next time.